It's good to see you. Good morning. I told the Bible class at the beginning we had tornado watches and winter storm warnings at the same time yesterday. I've never experienced that before, but grateful that you're here this morning. I'm thankful to have the opportunity to be with you. What we're going to do this morning, last month on a Sunday night, there were a group of us that recently went to Israel, and we talked a little bit about the Sea of Galilee a month ago, and I was going to do that tonight, but been called away. I'm going to go speak at a youth rally in Manchester. So Mark said, you know what, why don't you just do that on a Sunday morning? So I'm going to show you some pictures and from some things that we experienced about a little over a month ago, I guess, and some things that I'm grateful for. And then I've got a couple of things that I want to share with you just in way of some application and some lessons. So I'm thankful to be able to do that. If you've got your Bible, you can turn to Genesis chapter 15. I want to read just a little bit there, and then I'm going to show you some stuff. Genesis chapter 15. After these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision. Fear not, Abram. I am your shield. Your reward shall be very great. But Abram said, O Lord God, what will you give me? For I continue childless, and the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus. And Abram said, Behold, you've given me no offspring, and a member of my household will be my heir. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him, This man shall not be your heir. Your very own son shall be your heir. And he brought him outside and said, Look toward heaven and number the stars, if you're able to number them. Then he said to him, So shall your offspring be. And he believed the Lord, and he counted it to him as righteousness. That question, Lord, I don't see how you're going to fulfill your promise, is a question that's been on the hearts and minds of people really throughout time. Abraham was an old man. Abram at the time was an old man, and he didn't know how the Lord was going to fulfill his promise. God had laid out a very big promise that if you can even count the number of sand pebbles on the seashore, so your offspring shall be. And Abraham didn't even have a son. And God, through the working of miracles and providence and through giving Abraham blessing, fulfilled that promise. And we got to experience part of that promise just a couple of weeks ago. A couple of weeks ago, we started in the Sea of Galilee. And today, I want to focus in on the city of Jerusalem. And I want to do a couple of things. I want to show you some things that we got to see, and I also want to explain some things about why things are the way that they are. This is a map of Israel, and I'm sure if you've been in any Bible study in your life, you've seen this map. There's another map of Israel in the time of the kings, but Israel is this area here. You had the Sea of Galilee up to the north, and Jesus did about 90% of his ministry in and around this area. Jerusalem is down in this area here. And so you have major bodies of water. You have all kinds of different landscape. And the first couple of days that we were there, we spent our time in and around the Sea of Galilee and the Golan up in the northern part of the country in Capernaum and the places that the apostles were from. But then we went to the City of Peace. We went to Jerusalem. And I have to say that the Sea of Galilee was an exceptional experience, and probably just in terms of understanding culturally the things that Jesus got to experience himself and the culture that Jesus lived in, Jerusalem was a very different kind of experience. Because you have a lot of theological stuff going on, but you also have a lot of historical stuff going on where you really are in the crosshairs. That's probably not the best term that I could use. You're at a fork in the road between a lot of different kind of faith. Christianity and Judaism and Islam all in one city at one time. And probably because of the historical value, is why I'm about to say what I'm about to say, I don't know that I've ever been to a prettier place. The city of Jerusalem is an exceptionally beautiful place. The weather not so different from our own. And it is really a beautiful place. But it's also a place where you know that there are many, many, many people who don't believe like you believe. In the north, in the Golan, around the Sea of Galilee, you have a lot of Jews and you have a lot of folks that are there who are believers, who are Christians, because they want to experience what Jesus experienced. In the city of Jerusalem, you have a lot of Muslims. You have a lot of Jews. The politics there are thick. And understanding why things are the way they are is very difficult to do unless you experience it. I've got some pictures that I'll show you as time goes on. This is a mock-up of the way that ancient Jerusalem looked. And this was a really interesting opportunity that we got to see. This is not to scale. I think it was like 10%. Is that right, Chris? About 10% to scale of the way that Israel or Jerusalem looked during the time of Jesus. So this is when the temple had been expanded on by Herod. And this is the way that the city of Jerusalem would have looked. The rock that was used for all the buildings was quarried in that part of the world, and it all matched. And I'll show you some pictures of rocks and walls in just a minute. And if you were here a couple of Sunday nights ago, you know I actually have some rocks from some places that you can look at here in a little while. One of the things, and this is not in order that we experienced it, but this is kind of, in at least my own mind, some historical order. We went to the ancient city of David, which isn't the same thing as modern-day Jerusalem. The city of David is the place where David lived. This was even before David. This is the Hezekiah's tunnel that we read about in the book of Kings. When Hezekiah, in order to cut off water from the Assyrians, so the Assyrians couldn't come in and sack Judah the way they had Israel, he cut off the water and dug a tunnel thousands of years ago, and we got to walk through that tunnel. This is the pool of Siloam, which, because Hezekiah cut off the water, it forced water into a different part, and this is the place where Jesus healed some people. All of that happened in the ancient city of David. One of the things that became really clear in this part of Jerusalem was how many hills there were. You read in the New Testament about when people went up to Jerusalem. You see just how many hills there are. There are hills all around. And this is directly across, probably less than 100 yards away from what they think they have uncovered as David's house. And so we stood up there, you know, just a couple of hundred yards away from where David potentially could have lived. And we saw into valleys and we saw up hills. There are hills everywhere. And David, of course, lived at the very top point of the city. And I couldn't help but think about Bathsheba and that experience because from this point of view, you can see everything. Now, one of the interesting things, because this is the city of David, you get the biblical idea of hell or Gehenna. And what they would do is they would throw all of their trash into valleys outside of the city walls. And so really the biblical definition or the biblical idea of hell is the place where everybody throws their trash, where disease is rampant, where unclean people are rampant. This was outside the city walls down the hill in the valley. One of the last days we were there, we went to the Valley of Elah that you read about with David and Goliath. We picked up some stones there. This is the entire Valley of Elah from this mountain range or hillside to this hillside. I think I've got a panorama in here that shows you. It was really neat that the Valley of Elah is privately owned. Now, how cool would it be to have a deed to the Valley of Elah? There's no national park there. Most of the places that we went, in fact, almost everywhere that we went was a national park. You paid your entry fee, and you got to go into the park and experience it. Valley of Elah, for whatever reason, I don't know the backstory on that. It's just not a national park. You would think that Jews would love this story, really, above all things. This is the story of David and Goliath, and really, it's a farmland. And somebody, whoever owned that place, had just tilled the ground, and so there were rocks everywhere. So I came home with about 10 pounds of rocks from the Valley of Elah, and this is the place where the Philistines stood on one side and the Israelites stood on the other side. I may have that backwards, I don't know. But Israel stood on one side and the Philistines stood on the other side. And Goliath was somewhere right in here shouting to the Israelites for 40 days, the Bible says. And David, unlike anybody else, even including his brothers, wasn't going to stand for it. And so he ran into the valley, and you know the story. But that's the Valley of Elah. One of the things that you have the opportunity to do when you take a trip like this, and you ought to take a trip like this, is you get to see how things fit together geographically. And so David, how old do you think David was in this story, the story of David and Goliath? We don't really know, but David's a young teenager. Huh? He's a what? That's right. That's right. He's not very old. He's not an old guy. And this is only a couple of miles from Jerusalem, but from Bethlehem even farther. Now, can you imagine sending your, let's say, 13, 14-year-old son 15 miles away from home with hundreds of sheep by himself? Because that's what David was doing. David was a shepherd. He was keeping the sheep by himself, hundreds of animals that he was responsible for on foot, at least 15 miles from his house. Now, if you live here in Rickman, can you imagine sending your kid to the other side of Baxter on Interstate 40 by himself on foot for a month at a time? I mean, we don't let our kids go anywhere without their cell phone. And David is by himself, miles and miles away from home on foot, responsible for hundreds of sheep. There was a certain level of responsibility that existed in this time in a place like this that's different from what we got to experience. The old city of Jerusalem, these are the pools of Bethesda that they've uncovered. I don't really understand why it works this way, but every historical place that I've been is this way. You would think that when folks rebuild or build in an ancient city, they would just knock something down and then build in its place. That's not what they do. These pools that Jesus was in himself are probably, I would say, 100 feet, pretty good distance anyways, below where the walking level is of the city today. So they had to dig down. Anywhere you dig in Israel, you come up with some kind of, or especially in Jerusalem, you come up with a historical figure. The Muslim faith had filled these pools in. I wonder why. They didn't want people to think about Jesus. And so when they came into Jerusalem, they filled in. And this is in or near the Muslim quarter. These are the pools of Bethesda. Now, when we think of pools, we think of like a swimming pool, right? Place you go and you put your towel down, you sit around the pool. Pools in the ancient world weren't that way. They were a bathhouse. They were a place for that you could have spa treatments done. They were a place where ill people and sick people would kind of congregate because it was a very populated place, hoping for places. And this is one of the scenes, one of the backdrops in the Gospel of John, that Jesus spends his time healing people. That's going into the pools of Bethesda. Right outside the pools of Bethesda is St. Anne's Church. And I showed this about a month or so, 6 weeks ago. I don't remember exactly when. All my days are running together. But this is a Crusader church that was built in what is now the Muslim quarter of Jerusalem, right outside or across the way from the pools of Bethesda. It was built in the 1100s, so it's almost 1,000 years old, used or built by with the same stuff that's built, that the city walls were built of, the same stones. And this place represented to Christians that retook the city of Jerusalem, a place of God's faithfulness. When the Muslims retook the city, they turned it into an educational facility and then let it fall into disrepair. it was restored a couple of hundred years ago by Napoleon. And it's looked the same ever since it was born. I've never been to a place or in a building that had better acoustics than that place. If you want to pull that video up, I'm going to show that video. It's about a minute long. If you were here about a month ago, this is what it sounds like in that church. As they can try it just for another minute to get that pulled up, one of the most compelling things about that experience for me was, we're just going to skip ahead. One of the most compelling things about that experience for me was, I think the Lord providentially really designed that moment for our group and maybe for me individually, because I had just read a book about the song Amazing Grace. And then to hear that and to think about the story of John Newton and that in a place that's 1,000 years old, to immediately walk in and hear that song was an experience like I've never had. It's a really tall place, but acoustically, it's unbelievable. If this church, if our church went into that place, it would be tough for everybody to fit up to the front, but we could do it. You've never experienced singing like that before, which I think showed how important singing was to them. We got to do the Via Dolorosa, or the Passion of Jesus. I'm not going to show you everything there, but we went to the Garden of Gethsemane. And this is an olive tree in the Garden of Gethsemane. And one of the interesting things about olive trees is when what olive trees produce fall to the ground, or limbs or whatever fall to the ground, if they hit the ground right and get in the ground, they reproduce on themselves. And so olive trees can live for thousands of years. This olive tree is 3,000 years old. So this is the same olive tree, or at least in the garden, this would have been living, or a version of this tree would have been living during the time of Jesus. And so Jesus weeps over Jerusalem. Jesus comes down one of the hills, and he comes into the Garden of Gethsemane, and this is the scene in this garden, which probably the garden itself isn't bigger than this auditorium. And Jesus says, "Father, I'm going to do what you want me to do, but if you can take it away, take it away. Let this cup pass from me, but not my will, but your will be done." That's the way down to the Garden of Gethsemane. And this is a church, the Church of All Nations, which is right outside the Garden of Gethsemane, where they read that story over and over and over, really in perpetuity. That's Golgotha. What's Golgotha? There are two sites in Jerusalem kind of that disagree with one another. The Catholics have a site that they think is Golgotha, and the tomb. This is called the Garden Tomb, and this is run by a British organization, and a really compelling experience, and my personal opinion is where this happened. Golgotha is the place where Jesus was crucified. It's called the place of the skull. And from our perspective, it's hard to see, but if you get over there to where they park the buses now, you can see the face of a skull in the side of the rock. What's interesting about Golgotha is when the Muslims took control of the city, this is the place that they threw their feces and trash. So you say, why do they park buses in front of such an important site? That's actually a step up from what it was. I'll talk more about that in a minute when we get onto the Temple Mount, about how the Muslims feel about Christianity. This is the place where Jesus probably was crucified, somewhere on the hillside, somewhere on the top. In that same facility, there's a wine press that you read about in the story, and the door with a stone that could be rolled away. Inside the tomb, you can't all the way go into where they think the body was laid. It's not a very big tomb, probably half the size of the stage. And there's a couple of places you could stoop in and put a body in and get in. The temple is a compelling experience. And I know we're blowing through some of this, but I want to get to some biblical point here. The temple itself, the temple walls, were cut out of stones that are enormously heavy. The Lord had to help them, I'm convinced. There is no human way, at least that they can explain, really, for how they laid the stones. Yeah. You want to do the video? Okay, you should pull it up. That'll be fine. This is St. Anne's Church. It's four people singing, by the way, just four. Was immediately reminded of God's redemptive love. That moment was worth the whole thing. I mean, every moment was worth it, but that moment in particular will stick out in my mind, I'm convinced, for the rest of my life. To hear that tune, that song, in that place, after having just walked out of the pools of Bethesda, where Jesus shows His power over all things, I was just reminded of how mighty a God we serve, and how gracious a God we serve. These are the southern steps to the Temple Mount. This is the Wailing Wall. You familiar with the Wailing Wall? This is the place where the majority of Jewish people go. There is one place that's a little closer, but they go here and they congregate here at all hours of the day, pretty much, to pray, because it is as close as they can get to where the Holy of Holies was. The temple obviously doesn't exist anymore on the Temple Mount. We're going to go up on the Temple Mount in a minute. The temple doesn't exist. And because the temple doesn't exist, that's why the sacrificial system doesn't exist. So maybe you wonder, why don't they do sacrifices anymore? It's because the temple doesn't exist. The temple was tore down by the Romans in 70 AD, and I'm going to show you some pictures of that in a minute, but this is the place that they can go. This is the original wall. This is a wall that would have been laid during the time of Solomon. You let that sink in. Just the historical value of that alone is unbelievable. So they go up to the wall, and they put their hands on the wall, and they pray on the wall, because that is as close to where God's presence was, some believe still is, that they can get to. That's the closest access they have. It was a very holy place. You have to cover your head. Men and women can't be together. There's separate sides for the women to go in and for the men to go in. And that's where they pray, because that's the closest point to where God lives. And so, like, it's more of a direct line. And so that's where they pray. Historically, it's hard for me. Historically, not theologically, but historically, it's hard for me to compare this to much else. We had the opportunity to go up on the Temple Mount. Now, one thing you got to understand about the Temple Mount itself, that's where the temple was. So that's up on top of this structure here, okay? The Temple Mount is governed by the Islamic faith, and so they only let non-Muslims go up for a couple of hours a day, a couple of different times. And only during peaceful times. If it's not a peaceful time, you can't go up. We caught it at a good time, and so we got to go up on the Temple Mount. And it was an extraordinary experience. That golden dome, it's not a mosque, but it is an Islamic facility. That was built in the 600s, okay? And is near the place, not right on top of the place, but really close to the place where the temple stood itself on the Temple Mount. So this is the Temple Mount. That's Sean Kelly. Sean's in the back. And this is the Golden Dome. And what's interesting, and this will probably make you a little mad, is in Arabic, right on that golden part of the building, it says Allah is the only God and He has no son. So they tore down the temple and they wanted to stake their claim that they were the one true faith. And so they said, Allah is the only God. Yahweh isn't God. Allah is God. And by the way, He has no son. So they hit the Christians too. And that still stands today from the 600s, so about 1,400 years old. The Temple Mount was a whole lot bigger than I thought it would be. It was very big. Big enough that if you stood shoulder to shoulder and your stomach hit the person in front of you, hit their back, you could fit, and this number hopefully will sound a little familiar to you, 144,000 people on the Temple Mount. It's bigger than I thought it would be. They've done a lot of things up on the Temple Mount. That's a panorama of the Temple Mount. This is the place where God's presence was for many years. So you can't do much in Jerusalem or much in Israel without talking a little bit about exile. You have really beautiful buildings, well-built structures that then were toppled down by the Romans. This pile of rocks was from one part of the wall in Jerusalem, one part of the temple wall, that in 70 AD, the Romans came in and knocked the walls down. And that pile of rocks has been there since 70 AD. I think representing God's discipline on His people for not listening to His son. Another story that was interesting for exile, that's extra biblical. We went to a place called Masada. Mark, did you go to Masada? Went to a place called Masada, which is in the southern part of the country, the day after we left Jerusalem. And in Masada, there was a Jewish community that was up on a hill. You had to take a tram up, or you have to hike, which we did, have to hike up roads like that for about 2 miles, almost straight up. There were two of us, the youth minister at Jefferson Avenue and I, we decided we wanted to be idiots and hike up this place. So we didn't take the tram car. There was a Jewish community that lived at the top of this mountain. And after the Romans destroyed Jerusalem, they marched south to Masada. Now, there were only less than 1,000 people, I think. There weren't many people that lived in Masada, but the Romans wanted to make a point. They wanted to prove a point. And so they sieged Masada for a long time to try to get to the top because they wanted to prove a point that they were in charge, that they were in control. And so the Romans finally captured the city of Masada at the top of this place. I won't say much more than that because we've got kids here, but you ought to Google Masada and listen to the story about what the Jews did in response to the Romans when the Romans captured the city. Nobody got out alive. Nobody got out alive. And so Masada has a lot of historical value. We went to the Negev Desert, got to ride a camel, never done that before. My favorite quote from the trip is that a camel is a horse built by a committee. You think about that, let that sink in for a minute. A camel is a horse built by a committee. There's parts that you don't really need to get to where you want to go. Anyways, we got to ride a camel, and we got to experience the landscape. We got to see, I'm going to come back to that, there was a place that we got to see a modern-day Abraham and Eliezer who took us into his tent and showed us what first-century hospitality was all about. I'm going to stop with this picture and then make a couple of points and we'll be done. This is a wadi. You heard that word before? Now you know, or you'll be familiar with Matthew chapter 7, verses 24 through 27. I want you to turn there in your Bible. Matthew chapter 7, this is the last picture I'll show you. Matthew chapter 7, this is something that you'll be familiar with, starting in verse 24. Everyone then who hears the words of mine and does them will be like a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on that house. But it did not fall, because it had been founded on the rock. And everyone who hears these words of mine and does not do them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. And the rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat against that house, and it fell, and great was the fall of it. Now, you've sang the song, right? Wise man built his house on the rock. Foolish man built his house on the sand. We have a certain perception of what sand is when we hear that word, right? Sand's like, you know, when you go to Destin, right? That's sand. The only trouble with that is that kind, that doesn't exist in Israel. They don't have sand like that. They have sediment. They have little mini rocks. And what I want to point out to you, because the land of Israel in this part of the country is so dry. Now, you think we just got through a little mini drought. That ain't nothing compared to what the Negev Desert experiences and places in and around Israel in the Judean wilderness. This place right here is a washout where water comes in the form of rain from the sky, and it comes so quickly and it comes so fast that the earth doesn't soak it in, and it just creates like a river. And so it washes out part of the land. So this is a wadi. That is a place where the water washes out when it rains so hard. Now here's what Jesus is saying that we don't really think about or know culturally or contextually. This water that comes in the form of a storm that might wash this part of the earth out may come from miles and miles away. It may not rain here. It may come from the other side of those mountains. A storm may blow up on the other side of those mountains, and the curvature of the earth may bring the water through that mountain or on top of that mountain down and wash out this place. And so if you built your house right here, it may never rain at your house, but you still have a flood. Now, this is how I think that changes that biblical teaching. Ultimately, it's the same. Build your house on a rock, not on the sediment. Build your house on the rock, not on the sand. But you also have to use your brain and look around you. You also have to try to anticipate, even though it may rain miles down the road, where might that water come to? See, I think sometimes we limit that teaching just to when we experience storms in our own life. When rain comes and beats down in our own life, it may wash out some kind of truth for us. It may wash out the foundation of our own life. If this is true, and it is, it may be miles down the road. You may never even see it raining, but still get swept up in a flood. And so it's important to build your house on the rock and to try to anticipate as best you can what other people may do that would affect your own faith. So let me share a couple of things with you here in just a couple of minutes, and then we'll be done. These are some things that I think the Lord taught me through that and through other things. I got a couple things for you, and the first one is this. God was always the victory. We talked about this morning in Bible class in the book of Malachi. Whenever David or Solomon or Saul or the nation as a whole served God as their king, they always won. It was when they trusted in their own plans and they trusted in their own politics and they trusted in their own whatever that things began to fall. It's awfully easy to be deceived into trusting other things, and to walk around the ruins of cities really drove that point home to me. Ruins, by nature and by definition, fail because something was wrong. I don't want our lives to be something that people explore in 1,000 years. Because it came and fell into ruins. The second thing that I, and probably the most important thing, and the thing that I'll leave you with is this. There is now no separation. You know, the Jews go to that place They go to the Wailing Wall because they think that's where God still lives, and that's the closest access that they have to Him. The good news of the gospel is that God sent His Son Jesus to die on the cross so that He would live in your heart. He doesn't live in the temple. He doesn't live on the Temple Mount. We don't have to go to a special place or pray at special times. God lives within us right now. And if you can make a trip like that, you ought to make a trip like that. But the good news is, if you never do, the same God who lived in that place now lives on the inside of you and lives on the inside of me and is working the same kind of work that He worked for His people for His glory and our good today. That's the good news of the gospel. I know there's a lot of pictures. I know there's a lot of history. But the good news of the gospel is that Jesus offered Himself freely so that He and His Spirit would live in your heart today. And if you've never experienced that initially, this morning is a perfect opportunity to do that. If you don't know the Lord, if you've never known the Lord, if He's never lived in your heart, this would be a perfect opportunity to stand up and confess His name, to be immersed today. We'd love to see you do that. Maybe you have. I know a lot of you have. Most of you maybe even have. Maybe you've forgotten that He lives inside of you. He doesn't live there anymore. He lives here in you. And maybe that truth has just convicted you somehow, that you want prayers, that you want help, that you want to do it better in the future than you have in the past, to respond to that gift in an appropriate way. The story of God is big, and it's deep, and it's rich. The same God we serve today is the God that the Jews served thousands of years ago, and even to the beginning of time. If we can help you in what way we can to connect you to that story, we'd be happy to. If you've got a need, let us know what we can do while together we stand and sing the song of encouragement.